Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4, packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
If you've ever wondered about the dark psychology behind history's most notorious murderers, Mind of a Serial Killer is the podcast for you. Find Mind of a Serial Killer on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Speed City with John Massengill, Bob Varsha, and Jonathan Green. It's the fastest hour on the radio, Speed City.
All right, gearheads, welcome to the show. Welcome to our special post-Le Mans Father's Day special. This is John Massengill. I'm with Jonathan Green. Mr. Green, how are you, my friend?
I'm good, man. It's been a long 24, but a good one.
Yes, it has. And lots of rain, lots of action.
Ironically, you know, typical Le Mans, they didn't predict this much rain anywhere near. They said it might be a possibility of some rain, but not like it was.
Well, if you'd been on the text trail with Bob Varsha, he predicted it about Wednesday. He goes, oh, it's going to be horrible rain all up and down. I was kind of laughing because, you know, nobody can predict rain 4 days ahead, but apparently Bob Varsha can. So he called it.
Fair enough.
I was laughing at a tweet from Karun Chanduk. He said, can anybody tell me why there's no replay clips, you know, highlight clips overnight? And everybody chimed in and said, that's because it poured down rain for 4 hours and they were behind a safety car. It actually worked out really good for us here in the States because I went to bed and didn't worry about it and woke up and really nothing had changed because it had rained all night.
Yeah. Yeah, I woke up. I kind of fell asleep on the couch and woke up and it was pouring with rain about 5 a.m. And I was like, well, nothing's changed. I'll go back to bed.
Well, Kevin Kelly says, awesome, wicked race. And you know what? I'm not going to argue with that because there was so much. There was so much. And I know, Jonathan, you probably watched more than I did.
Yeah, I really did watch quite a lot of it. I got up yesterday and watched the start and then I left it on. And, you know, sort of did my day, but kept an eye on it. And there's no question that Ferrari totally deserved to win. They led. I mean, in the first 3 hours, they were line astern, first and second, with the 50 and the 51. And totally deserved.
Yeah. And, you know, there's so much going on, especially early days. I was watching my son and we're going to get a little bit indulgent on today's show because
Hell yeah. It's
Father's Day and I'm a dad of three kids. And if you're a regular listener watcher, you know that my son works for the McLaren team, the Inception, the 70 car who set the hyperpole, and they just were ecstatic about that. I mean, I told my son over text, we haven't talked, I've just texted him, and I said, no matter what happens on Sunday, they can never take away the fact that you guys were the first McLaren ever on the pole at Le Mans. How crazy is that?
Yeah, and what a great story that is for them. I mean, when you consider what McLaren are doing in Indy, in Formula One, and here at Le Mans, you know, that is exactly what Bruce McLaren, who also won Le Mans, would have wanted and would have wished for. So Zach is continuing a tradition that Bruce McLaren of New Zealand set a long time ago. And I do think that's a wonderful thing for McLaren to be at Le Mans racing their own cars.
Well, it was pretty cool, all the coverage they got. And, you know, it was pretty cool to see all of the excitement around McLaren doing good at Le Mans. And in fact, I recorded off of the official WEC stream. You know, I know here in the States, you needed to watch it on HBO Max. And, but I fired up the VPN and I was able to watch the WEC feed. And I got an interview with Zach Brown and also the CEO of the road car side, Michael Leaders. And so we'll have that for a little bit here later in the show. And it's pretty cool because they ask him about, would McLaren consider going to the top class at Le Mans in WEC? And he didn't say no. And in fact, I like the way the commentators caged it. They said it was kind of a soft yes to have McLaren. I mean, look at all the teams that are there now. I mean, in the last few years, it's just been amazing to watch. Well, look, obviously the obvious one is Ferrari coming back, but you know, because how many years do we have just Toyota?
Oh, that was a complete decade. Yeah, I mean, it was like Audi's dominance.
I mean, when we literally just had Toyota at the top class.
Oh,
just...
right. Yeah, exactly. Yes. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nobody else to challenge him. Yeah. It's great. I mean, you know, it's great to have Porsche back. It's great to have Ferrari after all these years and Aston Martin coming with an Adrian Newey design car. So fantastic.
Yeah. Hey, we got some cool comments here. David Lawrence says, good morning, fellas. What a race. Man, David, David is a huge motorsport fan. I see him tweeting about every single, you name it. And he said, happy Father's Day. Yes, happy Father's Day to everybody. Joe says, first time I've been able to watch it all. Wow, Joe, you need some coffee, man. I watched probably 7 or 8, maybe 9-10 hours. And I listened to probably about 6 or 7. So I got a good bit of it in. But yeah, David says, hate McLaren didn't win GT3, but congrats to Zach and United Autosport and their P2 victory. Yeah. And in fact, speaking of that, and speaking of my son's team, the Inception team, they were the highest finishing McLaren in the GT3 class because of the retirement of both the United Autosports cars. And you know, the 70 team,
40th overall, right?
Yeah. They were 13th in class because they had, you know, they had the bronze driver, the team owner, the funder, Brendan Nareeb. He was behind the wheel and he ran into something. I texted my son and he said he hit something. And as you might have seen,
yeah,
they had a radiator. You saw it, John. They pulled in the garage.
Yeah, I was watching live. You know, it was the most innocuous of crashes where he went off track and then came back on, hit a white line. And as he accelerated, he hit a bit of painted white line and the car just literally spun out of control. It was so, you know, it was one of those sort of, no, surely not, you know, and he just went round, he tapped the barrier. But in doing so, he damaged the radiator and they came back on the thing to him and said, look, you know, you've got no water, you know, the radiator's empty, you can't go anywhere.
Well, it was kind of fun for me because I actually got to watch my son work on the car because he was running around and...
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got an interesting role. He's kind of like, almost like an assistant team manager or something because he does wrench on the car occasionally, but he's on the radio and, you know, he'll prep parts for some of the mechanics. He's not on the wheel guns, but anyway... I don't want to go too much and be too indulgent about that, but
hey, an American win with United Autosports in LMP2.
Yeah, yep, that's pretty cool. Yep, in fact, David said that. He said, "Congrats on David Lawrence said that. Congrats to United Autosport." David said this. He said, "European or Eurosport broadcast made me feel like I was watching F1 with Alex Jakes, Alex Brundle, and Laura Winter."
Well, I was going to say, hats off to Eurosport getting in, you know, as many commentators and good ones that they did, because you're right, having Brundle there, Laura Winter there, you know, it was, and then guests like Weber and Christensen, you know, there were some nice moments, so that was good.
Yeah, I did watch the official WEC website, and Anthony Davidson was on there, which was really cool.
Yes, he was, yep.
Yeah, that was nice, that was nice. You know, let's take a quick break and we'll be back right after these messages.
when you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Alo, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not so secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Alo, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Our daughter Jessie loves playing detective.
A clue.
But since we discovered she has sensitive skin, we've been playing detective too.
We thought the problem was our puppy.
But it was actually our old detergent.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So we switched to Tide Free and Gentle. Tide cleans better than the leading competitive free detergent, and it doesn't leave behind irritating residues.
Plus, Tide Free and Gentle has no dyes or perfumes, so it's gentle on her skin.
Case closed.
If it's got to be clean, it's got to be Tide Free and Gentle.
I'm George Russell, and you're listening to Speed City.
Welcome back to the fastest hour in radio, Speed City.
All right, welcome back to your Sunday night with Speed City, special Sunday morning Father's Day edition. I've got this interview that I want to play because this was during the 24 Hours Le Mans broadcast. And this is Zach Brown, who's, of course, the CEO of the McLaren Racing. And it's also with him, Michael Leaders, who is the CEO of McLaren Automotive. And they talk about the future of McLaren in racing. Here you go.
Well, Michael, you're the road car side of things. Delighted to also have alongside us the man in charge of the racing side of the McLaren brand. Zach Brown, great to have you back with us. You've got sort of two irons in the fire here. You've got a jacket on there with the McLaren brand and another brand you're intimately involved with, co-owner of United Autosports. Tell us a little about the adventure so far, not just this year, but this weekend with United.
It's been awesome. First, it's been amazing to come back to Le Mans with McLaren. It's been quite some time. To do it with Michael and the whole automotive team has been awesome. I'm very proud of the effort. You know, 20 hours, we're running at the front. The car was super fast. Conditions were tricky, so fell a few hours short. But I think for a debut on a decision that was made, you know, relatively late, I think we got to be very proud of what the McLaren GT3 car did with both cars. Of course, we've got our LMP2. We had a challenge early on. One car knocked out of contention pretty early, but still going. But sitting here staring at the timing chart, being in the lead of LMP2, I'm not sure, with it pouring rain, adds a little bit of anxiety to the last 1 hour and 19 minutes and 40 seconds, but who's counting?
There's not one single viewer watching in the moment that wouldn't want me to ask an open question to you, gentlemen. There's two classes in the FIWC. It's stacked. It's been an astonishing race here at Le Mans. There's surely hunger to be in that top class.
We are open to it. We are really exciting. We think it's a fantastic class and definitely something which we could imagine. No decision yet taken, but I think for us it's a first step now in GT3, and there's a strategy behind that. But we will see in the future.
All right, welcome back to Sunday Night with Speed City, special Sunday morning Father's Day post-Le Mans edition. This is John Massengill with Jonathan Green. And Jonathan, we have a very exciting special guest, friend of yours. I want you to introduce our guest.
Well, I'm hoping that my own father may appear if he gets his numbers right. but he's as close to another dad as possible, and certainly one of the great dads of Le Mans itself. The one and only Brian Redman, who I think, I want to say, Brian, how many times did you attempt to win this ridiculous race?
15.
15 times.
Yes.
And you, I mean, you know, you're the perfect guy. We've seen Jackie Ickx. We've seen Christensen. You were in an era where, Le Mans has changed so much, and it's still what it was. But this is without doubt something, it belies sport in many ways. It's such an anomaly to do this race. Just sum up, if you can, just why we are so in awe of what the 24 hours is.
Well, it's, you know, probably arguably the most famous race in the world, I suppose. You know, Monaco, yes, Formula One, but Le Mans, it's got its own mystique, and it's changed so much over the years. Now, when I first raced there in actually 1967, there was no Porsche curves. You know, you came whistling out from Arnage, and then you went on this narrow country road with no barriers, and then over a blind brow into the White House corner, which was very tricky, where poor John Wolfe was killed on the first lap in 1970 in his brand new Porsche 917.
Wow.
And of course, no chicanes. In fact, although I've raced in the historic Le Mans with the chicanes in the real time, my last professional race at Le Mans was 1989 for Aston Martin, and there were no chicanes, you know.
I was there with you that weekend.
You were there?
I was there that weekend with Aston Martin in the red, white, and blue.
Yes, it was really, you know, it was a great disappointment to the owner, Peter Lavanas, because the car was just not as fast as it was supposed to be. And we found that out at the first race at Dijon. And so through the year, the team led by the engineer Ray Malek, they'd worked hard to make it better. But at Le Mans, it was just slow. I mean, it was good in the corners. If a Jag or a Porsche passed us going into the Porsche curves, we could stay with them until we got onto Tertre Rouge, onto the Mulsanne Strait. And then they disappeared. We were doing 215, and they were doing 245.
And of course, no Mickey Mouse chicanes in those days.
No chicane. And the only amusing thing was at the end of the race, by some miracle, it was still running. And we were in like 11th place with no hope of getting any higher or any lower unless, you know, through things happening. So I was a bit bored. And at Arnage, which is a right-hander at about 100 miles an hour in those days, it would slide very easily, the Aston. And so for a few laps, I'd slide the back out, and then I stopped doing it. And then suddenly, from the right-hand side of the road, a group of about 10 Brit enthusiasts held up this big sign, "Give us some oppo."
Give us some opposite lap.
Really, and the next lap, now, fastest lap. What a hope. And the third and final time, crumpets and tea with the Queen.
There you go. Well, that's some creative. See, that's what I also love, is the fans at Le Mans. They so love it, and they come back every year. They camp, they pick a spot, they've got friends that they meet up with. And so there's a whole world out there outside of the event itself, and that's what I love about it. John, we're having no luck with our special guest. I don't know if you've got any other ideas.
I do have another idea. I am about to text him a link that automatically dials the passcode.
Okay.
So I'm going to text him that, and hopefully he can just literally click the link and join the show. So we'll try that.
He's still very young, so he's learning this technology.
All right. Hopefully he's getting my messages, and we'll give that a shot. Well, Brian, did you get to see any of the race this morning, or actually for you, the afternoon?
No, I didn't. I do what I do with Formula One. With Formula One, we record the whole thing, but I watch it on YouTube, where they have a 20-minute summary of the race.
Yeah.
And I do that with IndyCar as well, and I'm going to do the same with Le Mans. I've been reading a little bit about the first 4 hours and then the first 8 hours, but I haven't actually watched anything at the moment.
Brian, what car you drove in 67 then, your first one?
67 was a GT40. Belonging to a lord of the British Empire, Lord Down. And he didn't enter the car under his name because he didn't want the publicity. And it was entered by John Wire. So it was a John Wire entry. My co-driver is a well-known British racer called Mike Salmon. And we stayed at the beautiful Hotel de France at Chateau Sieur Le Loire, about 20 miles from the track. And all the Lord Down's friends had come for the party. It wasn't, you know, the race was really just a very small part of the activities. And on Thursday afternoon, which was the last day, of course, we're all at the dining room table drinking still. Every lunchtime, each diner, everybody dining there, had a full bottle of wine in front of them. And they were expected to finish it in the next couple of hours. And of course, I wasn't drinking, but at about 3 o'clock, Lord Down said, "What time's practice?" Well, nobody had the slightest idea, you know, and being the low man on the totem pole, I said, "Well, I think it's at, you know, 5 o'clock." And so he said to his younger brother, the Honourable James, "Get Brian to the track as quickly as possible." So they brought their old Rolls-Royce limousine. This thing's about 7 feet tall. And I asked Lord Down, I said, "Don't you have anything a bit more modern than this?" Yes, he said, "but we don't trust the bloody frogs." So they brought the old limo. Well, now I'm being ferried back to Le Mans at 20 miles at high speed, you know, 70 miles an hour in this ancient Rolls-Royce limousine. And James was on a mission. I looked at him and I saw him gripping the wheel and his eyes were set. And in the distance, you know, on this narrow French country road, I saw a dish of a Citroën coming straight towards us. And I thought, So I started to slide down under the dashboard, you know, because there were no safety belts in those days. And anyway, James stood up and steering with one hand, he shouted at the top of his voice, "Get out of the way, you effing peasants." Which they duly did. And then in the race, Mike Salmon came in at the first end of the first session. And I'm all, you know, eager, my first time ever at Le Mans. And I opened the door and Mike just looked up. He said, "I'm terribly comfortable, old boy. I'm staying in." Well, the French plumbeur, who was supposed to just make a note of how much fuel you were taking and how much oil, he shut the massive racing snap-action filler cap, which was on the right front wing. And at the end of the first lap, but Mike went out with full tanks, when he put the brakes on at about 200 miles an hour for the Mulsanne corner, the fuel surged forward, the cap wasn't fastened properly, it flew open, and there was a massive fire. Huge fire. Mike was pretty badly burned, but he lived to fight another day. So it should have been me, you know, in the car.
Wow.
Brian, what, that was 1967?
Yes.
do you remember the color and the number of the car by chance? I'm just looking at all the ones that I can find on the internet right now.
No, I don't. It was green, but I don't remember the number. I could look it up, but it would have been entered by John Wire.
Okay, well, I'll see if I can look around, but you have to tell us, I'm envisioning in my mind this raw, just, you know, by today's standards, I can imagine it's just so different from a race car from today, but this raw, powerful, unwieldy beast that you had to, you know, twitchy, and I, you know, that's just my, you know, without ever having done it, that's what I'm envisioning.
Well, of course, the GT40, I always felt pretty happy in it. It was a very strong car with a good monocoque. Now, the Porsche 917, which was built in a tremendous hurry and was a copy of the long-tail 908, so it had a aluminum, or as we say in England, aluminium, tubular frame, and one reasonably healthy man could lift the whole chassis above his head. It weighed about 80 pounds. The problem was it was pretty weak in the middle area, and if you hit something hard enough, it broke in half. And of course, that's what happened then in its original form. In 69, the handling was terrible, and everybody thought the chassis was twisting, but it wasn't. We found later, in October of that year, that it was the aerodynamics. But the first private owner to buy one, his co-driver, Digby Martin, spun in a straight line going over the Mulsanne hump at about 200 miles an hour. And he drove it back to the pits. He got out and he said, "Thank you very much, John. I have now retired." Well, the three English drivers in the official 10-driver Porsche team, Richard Atwood, Vic Alford and myself, we all said to John, "Let Herbert Linge start. He's the factory Porsche test driver." And John said, "No, no, it's my car. I'm starting." And of course, it was the last year of the old style Le Mans start. And of course, the only person in the entire race who walked across the track and belted himself in was Jackie Hicks. Everybody else just jumped in the cars and shot off. And it's possible that when John Wolfe lost control at the White House corner on the first lap, that if he'd been strapped in, he might have survived. But he did anyway, he didn't. The good news is he took out most of the Ferrari team at the same time.
Wow. That's, Brian, these are amazing stories. Hey, guys, let's take a quick break. And Jonathan, we'll see if we can get Pop in. But you're listening to Sunday Night with Speed City, special Sunday morning Father's Day post Le Mans edition. Back after this.
This is Jay Leno from JayLeno'sGarage.com, and you're listening to Speed City.
Welcome back to the fastest hour in radio, Speed City.
All right, welcome back to Speed City, our Sunday Night with Speed City special Sunday morning edition for Father's Day. Happy Father's Day for everybody. Post Le Mans, we watched Ferrari win back-to-back. Unbelievable, really pretty amazing. Jonathan, I got to ask you, before we go back to Brian Redman, who's our special guest, I want to ask you about what you, you know, your take on the big picture overall in the race, but Ferrari coming back and winning it again, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, what we're doing today is getting ready for our own Lone Star Le Mans, which is in September. And Brian, you're very welcome to come. I'd love to have you. But we're doing our six-hour WEC round at COTA in September, and there's a special Father's Day. Buy one ticket, get your dad in free. But I think my overriding thing about this weekend is just how strong, and Brian again could talk to this, you know, he's suffered and enjoyed some of the best years of sports car racing. But when you look at the size of the 62 entries, the manufacturers with Penske, Cadillac, Porsche back, Toyota still there, Ferrari now winning. I mean, I don't think we've ever seen a more robust world championship and Le Mans entry in many years. We're very blessed. This is a very good era for sports car racing, and really excited for Andrew Craig and the people that put these events together.
Yeah, Brian. I mean, Brian, I've got to get your take on what John was just saying. We got 62 cars and the depth of the field with Ferrari and Toyota and Aston Martin and Porsche and on and on and on all throughout the field. I mean, it was an issue a few years ago, but that has been solved. We've got plenty of manufacturers in.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, it's the same in everything, isn't it? In Formula One, Formula Two, Formula Three, every form of racing is thriving at an unbelievable rate. I think it's you know, the amount of wealth that's about and the amount of importance of events like this is just huge. It's amazing. It is.
Yeah, and I didn't mention even Cadillac, of course, which we should, because they had a strong showing again. I think they
were everywhere. Yeah,
exactly. And I mean, I'm really focusing on the hypercar now, but you know, again, in LMP2, we had United Autosports, you know, the team that's partially owned by Zak Brown. I think he's officially the chairman and part owner. Yeah, just really amazing.
Your connection today.
What's to say again, Johnny?
Tell him your connection today for Le Mans.
Oh, yeah. Brian, my son is with the McLaren team. He's kind of a mechanic / assistant team manager, and he's at Le Mans, and he's his team won the pole for the hyperpole, they call it, in the McLaren. And it was the first time in history that a McLaren was on pole at Le Mans. And I told my son, no matter what happens, they ended up finishing 13th because they had a 28-minute pit stop after the radiator went south. They had a 28-minute pit stop, came back from dead last to finish from like 19th to finish 13th. And, so yeah, he's there. It's really, I'm living vicariously. Honestly, I could care less about the show today. I just wanted to watch what they were doing, and I got to see him on the television, you know, running around trying to help repair the car. So that's my connections.
Very good, very good connection. Very strong.
I think you're gonna have to call him, John.
Yeah, I think I'll try. Let me try to call. I'm going to try to call Jonathan's dad. It's Father's Day. Of course, Brian, you know him so well. So I'm going to try to call him and we'll bring him in on the old school way. And I'll bring him in on my phone and we'll connect it to the microphone. We'll see how this works out.
Well, of course, his parents, Ian's parents, bought my parents' house in Burnley, Lancashire. Hi. When I was 1 year old. So in theory, I've known Ian since then, although it was when we were about 17 or 18 and getting cars that it really, really happened. We both went to the same catering college in Blackpool, but a different times.
Okay, we have our special guest, Jonathan Green. Would you like to introduce our guest?
Yes, is that Walter?
It's Walter himself.
Okay, well, we've got a special guest for you because we didn't think you were going to tell the truth of any of your stories, Lamont. So I've got a fact checker on online as well.
I can hear him now.
Fine, Redmond, this is Ian Green. I'd like to introduce you.
Well, 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 somebody I haven't heard of for a long time.
Oh, really?
I spoke to him yesterday.
Morning, Brian.
Morning, Walter. See, you got up again today, which is good news.
Good. I can give them all the answers on that 1979 and I can relax.
Yeah, go on then.
I said, can I relax now that you're on?
No, no, you've got to tell us some stories and Brian's going to fact check it.
Oh, I see. Okay, so tell me when to start.
Go ahead.
Okay, we're talking about 1979 Le Mans race when Brian was invited to drive with Jackie Hicks to drive for the race that day, that weekend. And when Brian first got in the car in the morning, he wasn't very comfortable with it, but they persevered, and there were various things going on during the day, but they still persevered and went on to it, and they were in the leading position when late in the afternoon or late in the evening, I believe it was, Brian was flying down the Mulsanne Strait and about 170 or whatever it was, and clearly the back puncher went on the left-hand rear wheel and he spun at the bottom there of the Mulsanne Strait, hit the barrier. Luckily, there was a pool tip with a hacksaw in, so he got out and hacked the tire off it and returned to on the grass bikes, basically, very slowly, ran right back into the pits to get a new tire. This put them into about 50th position, or no, 35th position, I think it was. And Brian set off again, or I think Jackie set off again. And it went on like that most of the night, various things going on. And then about nearly 1 o'clock in the morning, or maybe two, I think it was, Jackie suddenly didn't come round, and he was on the Mulsanne Strait again and broken down. Luckily, they have a drive belt in the kit, and he was able to refit that and came round to the pits, saying everything was okay, but they were still having to sort it all out. And then eventually, at about 2 o'clock, I went to wake Brian up because he was having a bit of a slumber in the back there, below the pits, and he said, "What the hell is that noise?" And I said, "It's torrential rain, Brian, torrential rain." "Oh, bloody hell," he said, and his face went white. "I've not driven the engine for months and months and months in rain like that. What am I going to do?" And I said, "You're on, boy, you're on. You're definitely on, without doubt." So he went out, and clearly we were all extremely worried about him going out in its rain. But he persevered, and he kept going, and he kept going. And about he got into about sixth position, and it was looking good. And then all of a sudden, bang, crash, wallop, he's off again. And this time, Jackie Hicks, by the way, was driving at this time. And basically, it stopped again. And then it started again, and Jackie Hicks came in, Brian got into the car, worried to death with an impending doom, as he says in his book, or in his returns, and consequently, Brian ran about six or seven laps in torrential rain, but then was called in, and...
Hi, this is Jay Leno from JayLenosGarage.com, and you're listening to Speed City.
Welcome back to the fastest hour in radio, Speed City.
All right, welcome back to Speed City, our Sunday Night with Speed City special Sunday morning edition for Father's Day. Happy Father's Day for everybody. Post Le Mans, we watched Ferrari win back-to-back. Unbelievable, really pretty amazing. Jonathan, I got to ask you before we go back to Brian Redman, who's our special guest. I want to ask you about what your take on the big picture overall in the race, but Ferrari coming back and winning it again. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, what we're doing today is getting ready for our own Lone Star Le Mans, which is in September. And Brian, you're very welcome to come. I'd love to have you. But we're doing our six-hour WEC round at COTA in September, and there's a special Father's Day. Buy one ticket, get your dad in free. But I think my overriding thing about this weekend is just how strong. And Brian, again, could talk to this. He's suffered and enjoyed some of the best years of sports car racing. But when you look at the size of the 62 entries, the manufacturers with Penske, Cadillac, Porsche back, Toyota still there, Ferrari now winning. I mean, I don't think we've ever seen a more robust world championship and Le Mans entry. In many years, we're very blessed. This is a very good era for sports car racing, and really excited for Andrew Craig and the people that put these events together.
Yeah, Brian. I mean, Brian, I've got to get your take on what John was just saying. We got 62 cars, and the depth of the field with Ferrari and Toyota and Aston Martin and Porsche and on and on and on all throughout the field. I mean, it was an issue a few years ago, but that has been solved. We've got plenty of manufacturers in.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, it's the same in everything, isn't it? In Formula One, Formula Two, Formula Three, every form of racing is thriving at an unbelievable rate. I think it's the amount of wealth that's about and the amount of importance of events like this is just huge. It's amazing. It is.
Yeah, and I didn't mention even Cadillac, of course, which we should, because they had a strong showing again. I think they
were everywhere. Yeah,
exactly. And I mean, I'm really focusing on the hypercar now, but you know, again, in LMP2 we had United Autosports, you know, the team that's owned, partially owned by Zach Brown. I think he's officially the chairman and part owner. Really amazing.
Tell them your connection today.
What's to say again, Johnny?
Tell them your connection today for Le Mans.
Oh, yeah. Brian, my son is with the McLaren team. He's kind of a mechanic / assistant team manager, and he's at Le Mans, and he's his team won the pole for the hyperpole, they call it, in the McLaren, and it was the first time in history that a McLaren was on pole at Le Mans. And I told my son, no matter what happens, they ended up finishing 13th because they had a 28-minute pit stop after the radiator went south. They had a 28-minute pit stop, came back from dead last to finish from like 19th to finish 13th. And he's there. It's really, I'm living vicariously. Honestly, I could care less about the show today. I just wanted to watch what they were doing, and I got to see him on the television, running around trying to help repair the car. So that's my connections.
Very good, very good connection, very strong.
I think you're gonna have to call him, John.
Yeah, I think I'll try. Let me try to call. I'm gonna try to call Jonathan's dad. It's Father's Day, of course. Brian, you know him so well, so I'm gonna try to call him, and we'll bring him in on the old school way, and I'll bring him in on my phone and we'll connect it to the microphone. We'll see how this works out.
Well, because his parents, Ian's parents, bought my parents' house in Burnley, Lancashire, right, when I was 1 year old. So in theory, I've known Ian since then, although it was when we were about 17 or 18 and getting cars that it really happened. We both went to the same catering college in Blackpool, but at different times.
Okay, we have our special guest, Jonathan Green. Would you like to introduce our guest?
Yes, is that Walter?
It's Walter himself.
Okay, well, we've got a special guest for you, because we didn't think you were going to tell the truth of any of your stories, Le Mans, so I've got a fact checker on the line as well.
I can hear him now.
Fine, Redmond, this is Ian Green. I'd like to introduce you.
Well, somebody I haven't heard of for a long time.
Oh, really?
I spoke to him yesterday.
Morning, Brian.
Morning, Walter. See, you got up again today, which is good news.
Good. I can give them all the answers on that 1979 and I can relax.
Yeah, go on then.
I said, can I relax now that you're on?
No, you've got to tell us some stories and Brian's going to fact check it.
Oh, I see. Okay, so tell me when to start.
Go ahead.
Okay, we're talking about 1979 Le Mans race when Brian was invited to drive with Jackie Hicks to drive for the race that day, that weekend. And when Brian first got in the car in the morning, he wasn't very comfortable with it, but they persevered. And there were various things going on during the day, but they still persevered and went on to it. And they were in the leading position when late in the afternoon or late in the evening, I believe, if it was, Brian was flying down the Muzan Strait and about 170 or whatever it was, and clearly the back puncher went on the left-hand rear wheel and he spun at the bottom there of the Muzan Strait, hit the barrier. Luckily there was a pool tip with a hacksaw in, so he got out and hacked the tire off it and returned to on the grass bikes, basically, very slowly, ran right back into the pits to get a new tire. This put them into about 50th position, or no, 35th position, I think it was. And Brian set off again, or I think Jackie set off again. And it went on like that most of the night, various things going on. And then about nearly 1 o'clock in the morning, or maybe two, I think it was, Jackie suddenly didn't come round, and he was on the Muzan Strait again and broken down. Luckily, they have a drive belt in the kit, and he was able to refit that and came round to the pits, saying everything was okay, but they were still having to sort it all out. And then eventually, at about 2 o'clock, I went to wake Brian up, because he was having a bit of a slumber in the back there, below the pits, and he said, "What the hell is that noise?" And he said, I said, "It's torrential rain, Brian, torrential rain." "Oh, bloody hell," he said, and his face went white. "I've not driven the inner for months and months and months in rain like that. What am I going to do?" And I said, "You're on, boy, you're on, you're definitely on, without doubt." So he went out, and clearly we were all extremely worried about him going out in its rain. But he persevered, and he kept going, and he kept going. And about, he got into about sixth position, and the team was looking good. And then all of a sudden, bang, crash, wallop, he's off again. And this time, Jackie Hicks, by the way, was driving at this time. And basically, it stopped again. And then it started again, and Jackie Hicks came in. Brian got into the car, worried to death with an impending doom, as he says in his book, or in his returns. And consequently, Brian ran about six or seven laps in torrential rain, but then was called in and announced that they'd been disqualified. The bottom line of all that was that Brian and I went up into the bar with some very beautiful ladies and were having a rather nice time, and then Brian realised that our wives would be on the way back shortly, towards the 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock morning, and so he said, "We better go, killer, we better go, so because we're out of the race now and we don't want the wife to come back here, there's no point." So
I got it.
Sorry?
Carry on.
So I had a Jag XK 6, and I went, I was driving back, and he suddenly said, Ian, stop the bloody car. I said, "What's the matter?" He said, "You're on the wrong side of the bloody road, I'm terrified." So that's the story, basically. Here's a guy that's been doing 200 miles an hour all the bloody day long, and there I am, the major friend and old friend of his, driving like a bloody maniac. So he drove home, and that was it.
I think you'd find a friend, Brian, that could at least drive you home.
He drove me home, yes, that's right.
Brian, can you confirm or deny this story?
Yeah, it's more or less right. We don't need to go through it all again.
What stands out for you, Brian, as a year that it all either went? I mean, I know you never won it, and like I said, it's become a bit of a after dinner speech thing. But you know, you had teammates like Joe Siffert and Jackie Ickx, the great names. Is there one particular year that stands out?
Well, I mean, I did actually win the IMSA class twice, and of course today, whoever wins the class will tell everybody they've won them on, won't they?
Yeah. But,
you know, I never said that. We were fifth in 78 and 80 and won the IMSA class both times in Porsche 935s. And so the first year, not the first year, but with Porsche in 69, we had the choice of the new 917 or an also new 908 Spider, an open car with a long tail. And Joseph and I decided the 908 was better. We'd already won three races with the regular 908. Hello, I've lost everything. What have I done?
We still hear you, Brian. We still got you.
And so what happened was we were leading at about 8 in the evening in this new car when I'm just going to switch back. I don't know, I've got lost Zoom completely. Okay. That's a miracle. And then the gearbox overheated. It had never been tested, you know, with this long tail. So that was 69. Then 70, we're leading by four laps, 52 miles. My great co-driver, Joe Siffert, came out of the chicane. In those days, the pit entry was right, you know, close to the chicane by the pits. And there were three slow cars ahead of him, and he dived off to the right. And right in front of the Porsche pit, he missed a gear. And those Porsche gearboxes were very slow. They were synchromesh. Porsche did this deliberately, you know, to speed up development of the gearboxes. But the fact is that synchromesh gearbox was really slow. And at Le Mans, it probably cost 3 seconds a lap. You had to be so careful. It was so easy to miss the gear. And the 917 engine would go to 8,400 RPM for 40 miles. If it went once to 8.6, it blew up, and it went to a lot more than 8.6. And then in 1980, with John Fitzpatrick and Dick Barber in the new, brand new Kramer K3 935, delivered new to Le Mans, we were in and out of the lead. It was another horrible wet race, miserable. And it went on to five cylinders at about 4 in the morning. So now we're dropping back, you know, and this is where we finished fifth. But I was ready to go home, you know, when it went on to five cylinders. Dick Barber, who was a great, great enthusiast, and how he raised the money and put the teams together to do Le Mans so many times, I don't know. But early in the morning, perhaps about 4, I got out. I was cold and wet, but you wait for the driver who goes out to come around to see everything's okay. He comes in the pits. So through the rain, I see his hand beckoning like this. So I run around to the driver's door and I say, "Yes, Dick?" He said, "Brian, you guys are paid to drive in conditions like this. Get back in." And so with Jackie Ickx in the factory Ferrari, the last year until last year that Ferrari actually entered sports car race, you know, we were careful with the car. At 1.8 in the evening, we were a lap behind, but by 1 in the morning, we're in the lead. And then it got a fuel leak, and that took 20 minutes to repair, and then something else. And it finally broke. We're in second place with about 40 minutes to go. I was actually getting changed in the caravan, you know, the 14-foot trailer. And Jackie came in, he says, "We are finished. The engine has gone." So...
That's amazing.
Must be an emotional roller coaster each and every year. I mean, ridiculous.
Brian, those are amazing stories. I'm really kind of getting goosebumps. And the comments on YouTube, by the way, Brian, you can't see, but Kevin Kelly says, "Brian Redman is an icon." David Lawrence saying, "Loving these stories." So, yes, it's really amazing. And that story about the gearbox and the engine that you can rev all you want to 84, but if you go to 86, it blows up. That's just crazy. It's just amazing to think about the difference in machinery between today. I mean, now we saw a lot of cars, you know, not finished, but most of them were collisions and things like that. It's not so much where every car is fragile and that you have to worry. It's not this, you know, where half the cars die because in the whole race because of mechanical issues. It's such a different world today.
You can't make a gear change mistake today, can you? If you change down too soon, which in the old days was a huge problem with blowing engines up, it won't change gear until it gets to the right revs. So that whole gearbox thing, which was a big thing back in the day, is now doesn't exist. It's, you know, you just take it for granted. But I didn't really get going on the 79 Porsche 936 with Jackie Hicks, which Ian was talking about. What had happened was, on my first lap in the race, I'd come through the chicane by the pits, and the car didn't feel quite right. You know, and I had a fraction of a second to decide whether to pit or carry on. And I carried on. So I turn into the Dunlop curve at 180 miles an hour and spin. What happened was the left rear tyre going down. And I spun all the way round the Dunlop curve. I heard the body cracking and coming off. And, you know, that's how that all started, that whole saga. So in many ways, that was my fault. I should have pitted. You know, when the moment I felt something wasn't quite right, I should have gone in the pits. But I didn't. No.
I can't remember what year this was, Brian, but I know our fans will love this one. Am I not right in saying that you crashed one year, heavy crash, and then the damned ambulance crashed?
I don't think I ever crashed at Le Mans.
Oh, was maybe.
Your pop? What'd you say, pop?
That was in Canada.
Ah.
Oh, yeah, Canada.
When the car flipped, when it flipped upside down.
June 1977. I mean, I'd won three American Formula 5 championships with Mario finishing second for 2 years and Alonso Senior second the third year. And I would have won the first year, but Jody Scheckter won. I missed two races driving for Ferrari in Europe. I actually won five races. And Jody won four, but he won the championship. In 1976, they changed the rules. The reason was they'd had bigger crowds for Can-Am. Can-Am was finished in 1974. Right. Now this is 1976. So they said, in 1977, you've got to put bodywork on your open-wheel single-seater. So I arrive at Saint-Gervais in Canada for the first race of the new season. I've never seen the car before, but I know that prepared by Jim Hall and Chaparral and Franz Weiss, the car will be good. I go out, I come in, Jim Hall said, how is it? I said, it's good. And he said, what do you want, you know, to change the balance in the corners? And I said, drop the front wing a quarter of an inch. And on the next lap, at 160 at the top of the hill, it took off. And it went about 30 feet in the air, turned over and came down. That broke my neck, C1, smashed this shoulder, split my breastbone, broke my ribs. The roll bar broke. I went down on the road. It wore my helmet away each side. And yes, the ambulance blew a tire on the way to hospital. And when Harry and my wife arrived from England the next day, the headlines were Redman Amor, Redman is dead. And it showed a photograph of the ambulance with the doors open and me in the back not looking too good. And amazingly, which isn't very well known, the same day as my accident, Marion got thrown off a horse where we lived in Yorkshire. A bee stung its nose and it flung her off. And 20 or 30 years later, she was having a neck exam, and they said, when did you break your neck? So she broke her neck the same day.
Hey, oh my God.
Remember that.
Brian, they don't make men like you guys anymore.
They certainly don't.
No, he's not good looking.
That's true.
Hey guys, let's get our last break in really quick. And we'll finish up in this next segment. Listen to Sunday Night with Speed City special Father's Day Sunday morning edition back after these messages.
Hi, this is Max Verstappen and you're listening to Speed City.
Welcome back to the fastest hour in radio, Speed City.
All right, welcome back to Speed City. We have our special guest, this John Massengill, Jonathan Green with me, but we've got Jonathan's dad on via the phone, via my microphone, and we've got Jonathan, I guess Brian is officially your godfather?
He's actually my sister's godfather.
Sister's godfather, okay. Well, but we've got the legend, the icon, Brian Redman, and Brian was just telling about the stories of breaking his neck, breaking his shoulder, grinding off both sides of his helmet. And
I saw the helmet.
Do you still have the helmet?
The helmet's in France, in the hotel.
In France where?
In the hotel where you used to live, stay in. Huh. Okay. That's where I saw it, anyway.
Well, Jonathan, any other stories, Brian, that you guys want to get into?
Well, of course, I was extraordinarily lucky to have three really bad accidents and still be around to talk about it. I mean, that dangerous period, let's say the late 60s to the early 70s, I lost six teammates, you know, in racing. So every time we left home and you say, kiss the wife and kids goodbye, you know, they know as well that it could be the last time. It was so bad, you know, it was terrible. So in 68, when I just sort of made my mark, I was driving Formula One for Cooper and John Wire with Jackie Ickx in the long distance races in the GT40, the best long distance team in the world, you know, at that time. And I finished second to Jochen Rindt in a Formula Two race. So I'm doing Formula One, Formula Two, and sports cars. And I managed to finish third in the Spanish Grand Prix in my second Formula One race. And it was only because everybody broke down. I started last, and my great teammate, Ludovico Scafiotti, a member of the Fiat family, Italian nobility, really. And anyway, he was next to last, and so I followed him all through the race, in the ninth and tenth. Then we're fifth and sixth, I think. Ah, so I nipped past and finished third. And driving round on the back of an open Renault after the race, you know, I'd turned to my left and waving to the crowd. I turned to my right. And the winner was Graham Hill in the Lotus. Second was Denny Hulme. So Graham looked at me and his arm dropped and his jaw dropped. And he said, Christ almighty, don't tell me you were bloody third. So we'd just been at Spa and won the 1,000 kilometers in the GT40. We go back a month later for the Formula One Grand Prix. And on the seventh lap, the suspension broke. I had an enormous accident. I rolled over into a corner worker's post and hit a parked car. And it lost three wheels and it caught fire. And a corner worker was badly injured by one of the wheels that hit him. And he had a ruptured spleen and a heart attack. And so eventually we were helicoptered off to the University of Liège Teaching Hospital. And in those days, there were no specialists. You know, there were general surgeons. And the general surgeon that looked after me was Professor Ferdinand Orban, and he'd been a Winston Churchill aide in World War II. And he got me on the table, and he says, Monsieur Edmund, it may not be possible to save the arm. I smiled. I said, thank you, Professor. He said, why are you smiling? I said, because I'm here. John Cooper came to see me. What happened, my boy? I said, something broke. Well, that Thursday, Motoring News, a weekly, you know, Motoring came out. It said Redmond claimed the steering broke. And the editor got a call from John Cooper saying, I want a complete retraction. It was driver error. The editor of Motoring News said, Mr. Cooper, I suggest you look at tomorrow's Autosport. And there was a photograph taken head on just before I hit the barrier. A photographer having his first ever official photograph assignment called Peter Byrne. He'd taken this photograph head on and it showed the bottom right front wishbone on the ground.
Ah, vindication.
There you go.
Kind of. Yeah. And then in 71 at Targa Florio, Joseph had crashed the car the day before and it had been rebuilt overnight. And very unusually, John Wire said to me, Redmond, we'd like you to start the race. I said, well, I'd won it the year before with Joe. I said, what for? He said, I don't want Siffert and Rodriguez knocking each other off. You know, they were always banging. So when I started, the handling wasn't normal. And the course was 44 miles to one circuit with 800 corners. Oh, and just before the race, a Porsche engineer leant over. He said, Herr Edmund, if you must have the accident, do not crash on the right side. Well, 21 miles into my first lap, something broke in a fairly easy corner, and I hit a stone kilometer post right in the fuel tank on the right-hand side, and it exploded. I was on fire from head to foot, and it was 45 minutes before any help came. So that was another, I think, that was a pretty near miss as well.
You were on fire for 45 minutes waiting for help.
Well, the fire burns out. The fire yeah. burns, but, you know, but yes. Yeah.
Sister, I went to see him in hospital, and I cried on the way home. I thought he'd never, I thought he'd gone. I really did. He was covered in bandages and everything else, and I said, I've lost Brian. I went home, and I cried all the way home after seeing him. Anyway, he survived the bugger. He did it altogether. That was it.
Yes, it was a lucky one. Yeah.
Brian, but it was all worth it for the millions of dollars you guys got paid for every race, right?
But for 3 years driving professionally for John Meyer and for Porsche, I got $1,000 for Le Mans, Daytona, and Sebring, and $750 for all the others.
Wow. I mean, even if you convert the money to today's dollars, that's just nothing, you know. Maybe 25 grand or something. I don't know, but not much. But
well, I turned professional in 1967 when a friend of mine, David Bridges, said, "Do you want to turn professional?" I said, "What does that mean?" He says, "It means I'll pay you 30 quid a week, guaranteed for a year, with a car and a mechanic." So that's how it happened. £30 a week, about $50 for that time.
Amazing.
Jonathan, and when's the first time you saw Brian race?
I was about 4 years old at Brands Hatch, and or three, and I went with my dad, and I took my autograph book, and I got lots of different autographs, including Leila Lombardi, one of the first females in Formula One. I got Denny Hulme's autograph, and I think I got Bruce McLaren's.
Wow. Well, you guys, Brian, you're truly an amazing person to have gone through what you went through. And I know you did it because you loved it. And I can feel the competitiveness in your voice today still. And if you don't mind me asking, Brian, how old are you now?
87.
Okay. Well, I can still feel that competitive fire when when you're telling these stories. And we really appreciate you coming on the show. We are out of time.
I'm on 7 out of 10.
Yeah. You know, I feel like I've met you, Brian, because you've been on the show a few times, but I would love to meet you one day. Maybe if you guys ever get over here or if we ever somehow meet, I would love to. But thank you for coming on, Brian.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I hope it all went well for you and look the best of luck.
Well, and Mr. Green, Pop, thank you. Thank you for coming on. We got you on. We had to do it the hard way, but we got you, buddy. Thank you so much.
I loved it every minute of it. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I hope everybody enjoyed the show, and we'll get Brian on and get some more stories from him again. But thank you, guys. Hope you all have a great Father's Day. And if you haven't, call your pop, tell him happy Father's Day, and we'll talk to you next Sunday.
Hi, this is Max Verstappen, and you're listening to Speed City.
Welcome back to the fastest hour in radio, Speed City.
All right, welcome back to Speed City. We have our special guest, this John Massengill, Jonathan Green, with me. But we've got Jonathan's dad on via the phone, via my microphone. And we've got Jonathan, I guess Brian is officially your godfather.
He's actually my sister's godfather.
Sister's godfather, okay. Well, but we've got the legend, the icon, Brian Redman. And Brian was just telling about the stories of breaking his neck, breaking his shoulder, grinding off both sides of his helmet. And
I saw the helmet.
He still had the helmet.
The helmet's in France, in the hotel.
In France where?
In the hotel where you used to live, stay in. Okay. That's where I saw it anyway.
Well, Jonathan, Any other stories, Brian, you guys want to get into?
Well, of course, I was extraordinarily lucky to have three really bad accidents and still be around to talk about it. I mean, that dangerous period, let's say the late 60s to the early 70s, I lost six teammates, in racing. So every time you left home and you say, kiss the wife and kids goodbye, you know, they know as well that it could be the last time. It was so bad, you know, it was terrible. So in 68, when I just sort of made my mark, I was driving Formula One for Cooper and John Wyer with Jackie Hicks in the long distance races in the GT40, the best long distance team in the world, you know, at that time. And I finished second to Jochen Rindt in a Formula Two race. So I'm doing Formula One, Formula Two, and sports cars. And I managed to finish third in the Spanish Grand Prix in my second Formula One race. And it was only because everybody broke down. I started last, and my great teammate, Ludovico Scarpiotti, a member of the Fiat family, Italian nobility, really. And anyway, he was next to last, and so I followed him all through the racing, the ninth and tenth. Then we're fifth and sixth, I think. Ah, so I nipped past and finished third. And driving round on the back of an open Renault after the race, you know, I'd turned to my left and waving to the crowd. I turned to my right, and the winner was Graham Hill in the Lotus. Second was Denny Hulme. So Graham looked at me, and his arm dropped, and his jaw dropped, and he said, Christ almighty, don't tell me you were bloody third. So we'd just been at Spa and won the 1,000 kilometers in the GT40. We go back a month later for the Formula One Grand Prix. And on the seventh lap, the suspension broke. I had an enormous accident. I rolled over into a corner worker's post and hit a parked car. And it lost three wheels and it caught fire. And a corner worker was badly injured by one of the wheels that hit him. And he had a ruptured spleen and a heart attack. And so eventually we were helicoptered off to the University of Liège Teaching Hospital. And in those days, there were no specialists. You know, there were general surgeons. And the general surgeon that looked after me was Professor Ferdinand Orban. And he'd been a Winston Churchill aide in World War II. And he got me on the table and he says, Monsieur Edmund, it may not be possible to save the arm. I smiled. I said, thank you, Professor. He said, why are you smiling? I said, because I'm here. John Cooper came to see me. What happened, my boy? I said, something broke. Well, that Thursday, Motoring News, a weekly, you know, motoring came out. It said Redmond claimed the steering broke. And the editor got a call from John Cooper saying, I want a complete retraction. It was driver error. The editor of Motoring News said, Mr. Cooper, I suggest you look at tomorrow's Autosport. And there was a photograph taken head on just before I hit the barrier. A photographer having his first ever official photograph assignment called Peter Byrne. He'd taken this photograph head on and it showed the bottom right front wishbone on the ground.
Ah, vindication.
There you go.
Kind of. Yeah, and then in 71 at Targa Florio, Joseph had crashed the car the day before and it had been rebuilt overnight. And very unusually, John Wyer said to me, Redmond, we'd like you to start the race. I said, well, I'd won it the year before with Joe. I said, what for? He said, I don't want Siffert and Rodriguez knocking each other off. You know, they were always banging. So when I started, the handling wasn't normal. And the course was 44 miles to one circuit with 800 corners. Oh, and just before the race, a Porsche engineer leant over. He said, Herr Edmund, if you must have the accident, do not crash on the right side. Well, 21 miles into my first lap, something broke in a fairly easy corner, and I hit a stone kilometer post right in the fuel tank on the right-hand side, and it exploded. I was on fire from head to foot, and it was 45 minutes before any help came. So that was a pretty near miss as well. Yeah.
You were on fire for 45 minutes waiting for help.
Well, the fire burned out.
Sister, I went to see him in hospital, and I cried on the way home. I thought he'd gone. I really did. He was covered in bandages and everything else, and I said, I've lost Brian. I went home, and I cried all the way home after seeing him. Anyway, he survived the bugger. He did altogether. That was it.
Yes, it was a lucky one. Yeah.
Brian, but it was all worth it for the millions of dollars you guys got paid for every race, right?
But for 3 years driving professionally for John Wyer and for Porsche, I got $1,000 for Le Mans, Daytona, and Sebring, and $750 for all the others.
Wow. I mean, even if you convert the money to today's dollars, that's just nothing, you know. Maybe 25 grand or something, I don't know, but not much. But
I turned professional in 1967 when a friend of mine, David Bridges, said, "Do you want to turn professional?" I said, "What does that mean?" He says, "It means I'll pay you 30 quid a week, guaranteed for a year, with a car and a mechanic." So that's how it happened. £30 a week, about $50 at that time.
Amazing.
Jonathan, and when's the first time you saw Brian race?
I was about 4 years old at Brands Hatch, and or three, and I went with my dad, and I took my autograph book, and I got lots of different autographs, including Leila Lombardi, one of the first females in Formula One. I got Denny Hulme's autograph, and I think I got Bruce McLaren's.
Wow. Well, you guys, Brian, you're truly an amazing person to have gone through what you went through. And I know you did it because you loved it. And I can feel the competitiveness in your voice today still. And if you don't mind me asking, Brian, how old are you now?
87.
Okay. Well, I can still feel that competitive fire when when you're telling these stories. And we really appreciate you coming on the show. We are out of time.
I'm on 7 out of 10.
Yeah. You know, I feel like I've met you, Brian, because you've been on the show a few times, but I would love to meet you one day. Maybe if you guys ever get over here or if we ever somehow meet, I would love to. But thank you for coming on, Brian.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I hope it all went well for you and look the best of luck.
Well, and Mr. Green, Pop, thank you. Thank you for coming on. We got you on. We had to do it the hard way, but we got you, buddy. Thank you so much.
I loved it every minute of it. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I hope everybody enjoyed the show, and we'll get Brian on and get some more stories from him again. But thank you, guys. Hope you all have a great Father's Day. And if you haven't, call your pop, tell him Happy Father's Day, and we'll talk to you next Sunday.